like this cow.
It's kind of one of those things. It's like the duck. You know, you see a duck in the water, right? The duck looks like it's cool, but the duck's freaking working hard under the water. Wow, working hard. That's how our place is. We look cool, but we're working hard.
We're here, Red's Porch, Austin, Texas.
The epicenter
of all things physical therapy. Jared Aguilar here, Tyler Adams. We're here, Dr. Phil Davis of the training room, Dr. Peyton Sykes. My hands are shaking, I'm so excited. From legislative PT fame, single-handedly brought a little bit of direct access to Texas.
Definitely not single-handedly.
Well,
I appreciate the
notion. Yeah, man.
With his one hand.
You dressed up like Thor for Halloween once. I know. You've got strength there. Give yourselves a little bit of introduction here on the podcast to these people that haven't heard your beautiful voices.
So I am Dr. Peyton Sykes, physical therapist, Austin, Texas. I've been a physical therapist for almost 5 years. Sort of fell into this whole direct access thing just by asking questions, really. And the more questions I asked, the more involved I got, the more I found out, and that led me to finding out a lot of things, and I think that's what we're going to dive into today.
Juicy shit.
I'm Phil Davis. I've been a physical therapist for, well, longer than I'd like to admit, but been here in Texas since 2007. Been active in the community, pushing for direct access for a long time. I think I came to the forefront of the legislative push this year because I wanted more information than what our association was putting out. And in doing that, like Peyton, found out a lot of things.
So we just got a huge compromise. Sorry to get this close to your faces, but we're trying to preserve the audio quality here. We just got a huge compromise in Texas. Some people view it as a huge win. Some people view it as a huge step back. Which camp are you folks in?
Ooh. Well, so my whole thing, and maybe this is the academic in me, is that, you know, I really just want to present what I think a lot of people don't know, and that's what's in this new law and what this law potentially means for practicing physical therapists and, more importantly, for the patients that we serve. And so, I'm one of those people that I think I get both sides of things. If you've been fighting for this for 27 years, you know, to get anything is a victory, right? And I totally respect that. When you think about the long-term, you know, objective, I think that's where a lot of people start to fall into this other camp, and even some of the short-term objectives as well. And so, you know, again, I think there's a lack of awareness that is the main issue. And so, you know, my hope is to just bring that awareness forward and people can make up their own minds.
There's a very great political answer there. You did such a good job of saying a lot of things, but also saying nothing. and just to give people, and I want to let Phil speak as well, to give people a quick synopsis, can you explain the history of PT and physical therapy? We've come from having zero direct access, from a physical therapist can only perform an initial evaluation and then cannot prescribe treatment, cannot do treatment, they have to get a referral from that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. You know, it's really tough to say, you know, one side or the other side. There are pluses and minuses, as there are with anything. Is it a step forward? Is it a step back? I think time will tell. But right now, there's a lot that we don't know. And there's a lot that the PT community doesn't know about the potential for what's going to happen with the legislation that passed.
And what was the legislation that passed?
Well, you asked about direct access in the history of physical therapy, and I think that's an important... That's an important piece to be aware of, because if you Google, you know, what states have direct access to physical therapy, the first thing that comes up is a statement from the APTA that all 50 states have direct access. And while, you know, that may be true if you're simply talking about being able to evaluate a patient. That's certainly not true about being able to treat a patient. And I think that's an important distinction to make. And so while they're not wrong, it's one of those things where, you know, when you really look into it, that's one of the things I would disagree with, is that we don't have direct access. And so, you know, to go back to the history of it, for about 20 years, Texas has been able to evaluate a patient, meaning if you come, you walk into my clinic, I can evaluate you, but I cannot provide any treatment. Now, where the line on that is pretty damn gray, right? But you know, that requires me to send you to another healthcare provider. And there was four traditionally that were allowed to write a referral so that you could come back and receive treatment for me. So that right there obviously cost the patient time and money that, you know, may or may not have been something that they felt like they even needed.
Can I stop you for 1 second?
Sure.
What exactly is direct access then?
Well, I think it's one of those in the eye of the beholder things. My definition of direct access is pretty uncompromising, and I use that word deliberately. There are multiple levels when you look at the APTA. You can look at state by state, you know, who has what, and they use terms like unfettered versus with provisions versus with restrictions.
How great is unfettered, right? That's a great, sexy
It's a pretty term, right? I mean, it's almost like feathered, you know? It's like Hayden Christensen's hair in Star Wars, you know? It's like, it's pretty sounding.
That's some prequel shit.
Wait, now, is that fettered hair or is it unfettered hair?
Yeah, I think that's the intent of using that term versus unrestricted, right? Unrestricted sounds a lot more abrasive, I think, in a lot of people. And I'm speculating, but for me, cut to the chase, man. We have restrictions. We have restrictions as a profession, and that's what I think is a problem.
Some states people can't do dry needling. Some states people need a script to perform a manipulation, which is pretty stupid because I'm like, all a manipulation is a joint bubble fart. And look, I'm doing it right now. My finger's on live. Come take me, you fucking coppers.
No. Good thing you're in Texas, or that might be illegal.
Hey, it's crazy the restrictions that some people have in some different states.
Well, I think that also speaks to, unfortunately, the fragmentation of our profession. When you look at, for instance, the PT Compact, right? The PT Compact, and I'd have to check the numbers exactly how many people are involved right now, or how many states, I mean, are involved right now, but under the PT Compact, which ironically, Texas was one of the first states, I think number 8, I could be wrong, but to get in on that PT Compact, under that PT Compact, my license is good in Colorado, and a person in Colorado, a physical therapist in Colorado, their license is good here as well. What that means, physical therapists in Colorado have had unrestricted direct access for 35 years or somewhere about, right? So I can treat somebody in Colorado without having to take an extra exam, without having to pay for an extra license, and have all the benefits of unrestricted access. But if somebody from Colorado comes to Texas, the opposite is true. I can't treat that person because, under current law, I cannot treat, I can only evaluate. And that changed slightly with this new law, but it's still very restricted compared to what they have in that state. So you have 50 different associations with 50 different rules and regulations, all under the umbrella of one profession.
And can you explain that? We just made a compromise, right? That's what we hear. That's what we hear a lot on the social media, in all these Facebook groups that are handled well. Like, a lot of good dialogue handled well by a lot of great people. And can you explain the compromise that was just had, and who made the compromise?
Yeah, so, I mean, do you want to know a little bit about the history leading up to that compromise, or do you want to know what's in it?
I am a third grader, and I'm just trying to get into PT school. Explain it.
So again, this is kind of where I fell into this whole process, was just sort of asking questions, right? And it started, I'm probably going to take you a little bit further than you want me to, but it started with, you know, the midterm elections were up, and Charles Schwertner, who's an orthopedic surgeon based primarily out of Georgetown, Texas, had gotten reelected. Now, for those of you that don't know, Charles Schwertner has been instrumental within the past 3 or 4 legislative sessions in blocking any sort of direct access efforts for physical therapy.
That's because he cares about people. So.
Well, as an orthopedic surgeon, of course he does.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had heard that he had gotten reelected, which, by the way, was not by a large margin. It was somewhere in the 4 or 5%, right? But
it may have had something to do with the little scandal that was going on.
Yeah, well, that was the surprising part.
A scandal, you say?
Let me check my phone real quick.
Easily.
I got a message.
Easily Googleable. Googleable. But yeah, so I had heard nothing. I'd heard nothing from anybody about that. And so I come to find out, I will say that the association had put key contacts in his district to try to prevent him from getting reelected. But at the time, I had heard none of this, right? And I thought, well, I'm a physical therapist. I'm not that far from Georgetown. How have I not heard about this? So I really just started searching. I got on Facebook looking for groups dedicated to direct access, and that's how I came across the 2019 Texas Physical Therapy Legislative Affairs Group, which was created by the Governmental Affairs Committee Chairman, Dana Tu. So in that group, I started connecting with people. I started finding things out, things about our strategy, this and that. To sort of fast forward in the short story of everything, our bill had gone through the legislative process, which I'm more than happy to go into more detail on, but essentially got sort of punted into a subcommittee, right? And so this subcommittee was, correct me if I'm wrong, House of Health Professions.
Yeah, it was the Health Professions Subcommittee within the Public Health Committee,
right,
in the Texas Legislature.
Right. So we got put into this committee. There was five legislators involved there, two of which were already co-sponsors for HB 29, which was the bill that we were putting forth. And originally, this bill was seeking 30 days of direct access treatment. So you come into a physical therapist without having to have a referral. You could be treated for 30 days. After that, you would need to gain, again, that referral from another provider.
Isn't that a compromise from what we actually wanted?
In my view, yes. I mean, again, this is where my definition of direct access, I think, differs from a lot of different people. But, you know, so to keep it objective, we got kicked into this House subcommittee, which was chaired, which essentially means was headed, by Dr. J.D. Sheffield. And J.D. Sheffield is a known member of the Texas Medical Association. And essentially, even with two co-sponsors on our bill, that left two people undecided and one member of the TMA who had the control to basically say, should we put this bill to a vote or not? And in layman's terms, if he does not choose to put that to a vote, that bill falls by the wayside, and that's what we call a table veto. So essentially, our bill, and this is from the words of several members of the TPT Association, the Texas Physical Therapy Association, directly from their mouths, our bill was dead in the water, right? And so, again, this goes back to how you look at things. Did you want something or did you want nothing in the fight, you know, going forward? So because that bill was dead in the water, the executive director of the Texas Medical Association, the executive director of the Texas Orthopedic Association, and of course our executive director, Craig Tungett, of the Texas Physical Therapy Association, sat down with State Representative Ina Menjarez in a room and came to a compromise, which is the infamous compromise on House Bill 29. That compromise states, first and foremost, that if you are a doctor of physical therapy with 1 year of physical, 1 year of experience, then you have the ability to treat a patient for 10 business days.
Holy shit!
That's consecutive 10 business days.
Oh, that's not as cool.
That's not. If I see you Monday and Wednesday, that's two days.
No.
And then the next Monday and Wednesday, that's 4 days, right?
Essentially two work weeks in the eyes of the general public.
That's like 10 times when the Earth spins on its axis.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay.
Is this a globe model of the Earth or is it flat Earth?
Oof. Man, that's a whole other
question.
Yeah. Nah, loopholes, gray area.
We'll have to consult Kyrie Irving on that one. I don't know.
That's right. I'm a flat earther, so 10 days is like...
It's time is a flat circle, right? If that's the case, then we're doing good. Mm-hmm. So 10 days if you have a DPT and you have 1 year of experience. If you are residency or fellowship trained, you have 15 days, essentially 3 working business weeks, right?
Now,
wait a second.
Uh-oh.
It's not just anyone who's resident to your fellowship trained, is it?
No, it's a doctor of physical therapy.
And resident to your fellowship trained.
Right.
Now, does that include if you're board certified?
That's a question that we're waiting to find out, actually. So, as you'll see with a lot of this compromise, the new Practice Act, which is the law that was passed, leaves room for a lot of questions. And, according to the process, the PT and OT Board of Examiners is the body that is responsible for updating our rules and regulations based on that law.
And this is different than the Texas Physical Therapy Association. These
it's are different from the entities. Executive Board or the Assembly of the Texas Physical Therapy Association.
Who appoints these people at these different organizations?
The governor. So all these people are appointed by the governor. So each of these two entities have nothing to do with one another. The Texas Board of Physical Therapy Examiners is separate and distinct in every way from the Texas Physical Therapy Association. The only overlap may be that some of the physical therapists who are on the licensing board are also members of the association.
Which is very interesting considering, how much influence the executive board or the assembly, if you will, had in updating this law or fighting for this law without any oversight from the people who are going to update the rules and regulations based on this law.
Those being the examiners.
Exactly.
Who are appointed by the governor.
Who are appointed by the governor, yes.
I'm getting it. I'm getting this.
And to, just to highlight, these are things I was not aware of, even as a member of the association for several years. I mean, the structure is, unless you're looking for it, I guess you have to look for any structure, so, But yeah, so that's part of the compromise. If you do not have a DPT, meaning if you are not a doctor of physical therapy, then despite how many years you have been practicing, you have to obtain 30 hours of continuing education in specifically differential diagnosis.
But they have courses for that, so that's not a big deal.
Well, they do have courses for that. Do you know the going rate for continuing education?
No, I thought they were free, weren't they? That's not part of the new law?
Not part of the new law.
Oh.
No. Quite expensive, right? Not counting time that you have to take off and travel, to where these courses may be held. Right. So, anyways.
But, Peyton, you're upset because you don't have a doctorate or a residency, right? That's why you're mad about this, right?
Right? Putting me on the spot, I actually do have a residency and a doctorate.
You're saying you have both? Oh, you would have the maximum amount.
I benefit the most.
Now, why do you care?
Yeah.
Why do you care?
Well, I know plenty of PTs, and I emphasize PTs who are not DPTs, who have been practicing far longer than I have, who I have learned a tremendous amount from. And to me, to be able to say that I have jurisdiction or I have special privileges over that person, morally, it just doesn't sit well with me.
How many, I'm just going to throw out, a question. Who knows if you have the number to this. How many PTs in Texas would you say are residency trained?
That is about, from the numbers that I've been quoted, that is about 3% of the PTs in the state. It's about 300. That's it, 300. And there are roughly 17,000 PTs in this state.
Texas is a pretty big state.
It's a pretty large state. 17,000 PTs, 3,000 PTAs, 3% of those are residency or fellowship trained.
I think your math's a little bit off. It's 1.76%.
Wow. Interesting. Like I said, these were the numbers that were quoted to me.
The 1%'s never good. Hate them. Hate them.
So, yeah. I mean, when you consider, and this is the pitch that I got when I earned my residency as well. And again, Phil made an interesting point earlier. There are people who have gone through a residency but have not passed board certification. So do they fall under the same benefit? And that's something that we're waiting for the updated rules to find out, essentially. But when I did my residency, I was told that around 8% of the physical therapists within the country go on to complete a residency or a fellowship. And it's obviously less for a fellowship because that would be the next step. So you're talking about a very, very small fraction of our profession, which, by the way, has never received in any other state this type of privilege. They have been allowed in some states to practice earlier, meaning you don't have that 1 year wait period of clinical experience. However, they've never been allowed more time to treat a patient just based on credentials.
So is residency and fellowship training the same as that board certification? What if you don't go through that residency and you get board certified? Are you included?
Again, questions that we're gonna have to wait to find out.
And so, like, currently the examiners are waiting to have to determine and write up all the rules, which, no?
No, they're writing those rules now.
Who gets to determine how these rules are interpreted? Are there anybody, can we influence them in any way?
So, I spoke with some members of the PTOT Board of Examiners, and what I was told, and this is public knowledge too, the first part anyways, that there is a meeting on July 18th and 19th, and it is open to the public. And on the 18th, they will be meeting to discuss these rules, you know, gather any input that they can, you know, and of course, you know, meet to sort of decide what is the best action going forward. On the 19th, they will be proposing what they feel is the best first draft, if you will, of these updated rules. And both of those meetings are open to the public. There will be a short time at the beginning of both of those days designated for public opinion or public, you know, statement. I've been told that it will be a short amount of time.
Right? 3 minutes.
Excuse me?
3 minutes.
3 minutes of what?
3 minutes of public opinion, essentially.
That's per person who registers to speak.
Okay. And then from there, those rules will essentially be dispersed at what date?
I don't think the date is clear, but the information put forward by the board says that on the second day, July 19th, mm-hmm. they will submit that information to the Texas Register for public comment. The public comment period, again, it's a little bit unclear, but the adoption of the new rules is supposed to be between October 11th and November 1st of this year.
New rules. Any Bill Maher fans out there? Yeah, we got it. We watch real time.
Now, what's important to note about that is it's open to public, which means that anybody who opposed this bill, right, or anybody, let's say, involved in the compromise, also has the ability to come in and make their opinions known as well. So when you consider that the TMA and the TOA have been our primary competitors for every legislative session, you know, on record.
Why do you think that is?
That's another good question.
What do you do with your hands there, Phil?
It's all about the money.
I will tell you what they say. Right.
Patient safety is
a big part of it, right? And they claim that we cannot make a medical diagnosis. Right. Therefore, we cannot screen out for serious pathology. And because of that, the patient is sort of at a disadvantage, or at least in harm's way, so to speak. They also strive for what they call a comprehensive healthcare model, which means that they would like to have healthcare providers of every sort of walk of life, so to speak, within one house. But of course, that being with the oversight by the physician.
And that's like, for me, like when I look at Australia, Sweden, London, Spain, all those places in Europe, I'm like, those places suck. Look at all these people with chronic health disease, you know, and I just see all the physios treating them all willy-nilly. And it's crazy how many people are just suffering out there from the physios doing all their harm.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what aspects you want to look at. I mean, when you look at chronic pain, right? So there's a lot of research on chronic pain. Even in 2016, showed that the vast majority of the world's hydrocodone was produced and consumed in the United States.
That's the good stuff.
And when I say vast majority, I'm talking like 97%+. So you also look at the research that shows the benefit of conservative care, right? Physical therapy, addressing somebody's, you know, contextual factors as well as their physical factors. Having a healthcare provider that spends more than 10 to 15 minutes with them. You know, physical therapy has produced a surplus of research that shows that we are effective at treating chronic pain. And when you look even just last year at 2018, there was a health services research study that showed that a patient is 89% less likely to receive a prescription for opioids if they choose physical therapy first. So when we talk about this comprehensive care model, you know, we collaborate with physicians. I've sent people back to physicians for what we call red flag, you know, conditions that are outside of the scope of physical therapy. The question is, why is it that I can do that, you know, as an autonomous professional, yet you can't do that on the other end, refer somebody to me without this extra charge or without this extra fee for service?
And two things to circle back on for any listener that wants to get active, any Texan especially, or any other person in their state with some form of restricted access, where can somebody register to go and get their 3 minutes of fame? And do we know where the event is going to take place where we can come in and try to influence the rules?
So you can get that information by contacting the PT board directly. And that's the Texas Board of Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Examiners.
Just go on their website?
Correct. ptot.texas.gov.
And also follow them on Instagram. Tyler, what you got, man? What you got? You got some questions for these folks?
So let's circle back to the compromise for a second.
That's
right?
Good. I like where your head's at.
Right. Speak a little bit more on that, because I feel like there's still more on the table there.
There actually is a lot more. So
what?
A lot more.
One of the and just to hit on what I just talked about, right? So you know, being able to diagnose medical conditions or to screen out for serious pathology. Ironic that. One of these stipulations is that a physical therapist who does not have a doctorate has to complete 30 hours of continuing education in differential diagnosis. Right. So we'll get to this with this waiver that is included in the compromise.
What's this you say?
Oh, so if a patient comes to a physical therapist outside of having a referral from another provider, which by the way, those providers include a physician, chiropractor, a podiatrist, or a nurse practitioner.
Also a dentist.
Dentist, sorry. Yeah. Five.
So those people...
Well, there may be more. It's not completely defined within the law.
All those people can write a script for physical therapy.
All of them can write a script for their physical therapy, but if you notice, not all of them can provide a medical diagnosis.
Well, that's weird.
Wait a second. Wait. Chiropractors can't do medical diagnosis?
Would you like to elaborate on that?
So in reviewing the Chiropractic Practice Act, they are not restricted in any way for providing medical diagnoses. But PTs? No medical diagnosis here.
Now that's key when you look at the waiver that is included. So in this compromise, like I was saying, if a patient comes to you outside of gaining a referral from one of those providers, they must sign a disclosure. And in that disclosure, one of the first bullet points is that what we as physical therapists provide is not based on a medical diagnosis. The second bullet point, and I'll just run through all three. The second one being that what we do is not based on radiographic imaging. The third being that your care under a physical therapist may not be covered by your health plan or your health provider. And now, you know, I've heard arguments on both sides of this, right? And some people have claimed that, you know, this is just one more form, right? You go to the physician, you get a stack of paperwork. How many people actually read that, right? Now, I get that argument, right? We do have to sign a lot of things. I don't read through my Apple disclosure every time I, you know, log into iTunes.
You should.
I've probably admitted or agreed to some things I don't want to, you know, don't want to agree to. But, you know, so that is an argument, and I get that, right? But we're a profession, and I can speak to this as an academic that preaches informed consent. Right, so if a patient comes into my clinic, I'm not doing anything to that patient that they're not well informed about, you know, going forward, right? And they have to agree to that. And if they don't, then that's fine. I can change my treatment, I can change my approach, or they can simply seek services elsewhere. That's the right of the individual, that's the right of the patient. Now, what's really interesting about this whole disclosure, right, is the first bullet, which is, we're not allowed to make a medical diagnosis, or that what we do is not based on a medical diagnosis. And while some people would say, yeah, well, we don't. We're physical therapists. We make diagnoses based on dysfunction, right? And you know, that's something that largely I would agree with, right? Physical therapy diagnosis, right? So you come in, you can't move very well. I help you move better.
We're the movement experts. That's what we are.
We're movement optimists.
That's what we do,
right?
But when that chiropractor sends a referral, are they sending us their chiropractic diagnosis?
That is not something that happens. You will not see another diagnosis specific to a profession at all in the medical community. And the reason that is...
Nurse practitioner diagnosis?
Nope, doesn't exist. The reason that is because we all use ICD-10, which is the International Classification of Disease.
Always wonder what that stood for.
And that's important because if you, as a provider...
ET school failed.
If you, as a provider, want to submit for authorization or reimbursement from a third-party payer, right, and we could go through the list of names there, one of the forms that you have to fill out includes... What does it include, Phil?
It includes that ICD-10, otherwise known as a diagnosis code.
So without being able to provide a diagnosis code, which is basically what this language says, we can't truly submit for reimbursement without having the ability to diagnose, meaning we still don't have the autonomy to be able to provide people with care without the restrictions of an outside provider.
So you're telling me it's almost like it's not even a compromise.
I mean, again, that goes back to, you know, what you feel is a step forward or a step back.
Yeah.
Now, the radiographic imaging part, you know...
Well, that's cool because we know imaging is accurate, and it's, you know, once you get an image, it is a pretty accurate description of what you got going on. So
yeah,
that
tells
cool
you exactly
that.
What to treat.
Right, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, totally.
Well, when you consider that, 80% of people have degenerative findings, yeah, you know, with no symptoms whatsoever, you know, those findings being on either x-rays or MRIs, I mean, yeah, of course, that's, you know...
Wait,
something that...
My MRI for my back pain, though, that's important.
Yeah.
I'm not the 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
I'm a 2.
Well, sure.
And how are you going to know if you have a slipped disc or not?
Or cancer.
Right?
I need to know right away.
Well, I think there's a course titled Differential Diagnosis that helps you figure out if that truly is a musculoskeletal problem.
Yeah.
But we're not allowed to use the information from that course, right?
Well, under this new law,
wait, this
restricting
is getting way too confusing.
Yeah. So now imagine, put yourself in the position of a PT or OT board of examiners and trying to regulate this, right? How do you know which PT has what credentials, how long they've been practicing, what degree they have, and being able to say you've acted within the confines of your new practice that.
It's almost as if this was set up for it to fail. That's what I don't.
What about liability insurance? That's in there too. You gotta have it. How do they know?
All good questions. All questions that we're waiting to find out, hopefully, by these July meetings.
Do medical doctors have to have liability insurance in Texas? Anybody know?
I don't know.
Nope. Not here.
What?
Just PTs.
The people that
we're dangerous, man.
The people that cut on people.
Yes,
they
those
don't.
People.
They don't need liability insurance.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Get deep into the spine.
I mean, I might poke a infraspinatus now and then.
Hey,
but I'm not cutting into somebody's spine.
Let me just open you up, get all in there. Don't need any sort of liability.
Yeah. I'm over here worried about puncturing a lung. That's why I don't do. I don't fuck around with infraspinatus. I'm still scared.
So would you believe that we haven't covered everything?
There's more? There's more.
There's a little bit more.
Is this the juicy part?
I mean, what part hadn't been juicy?
That's true.
So in the current language that we have, right, before this law, this new law goes into effect, one of those outside providers, which we mentioned earlier, we listed earlier, right? So one of those outside providers writes you a referral, right? That referral, despite whatever they may write in terms of duration or number of visits, right? Doesn't matter, like, you know, if they say 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or four visits. That referral was good for an entire year. 1 year.
Covered.
I got it.
Boom. Still is, right?
Not under this new law.
Wait a minute.
Right now we're good, though.
Wait a minute.
Right now, until September 1st, this still holds true. After September 1st, it will not be true anymore. So under this new law, and this is from, a member of the PTOT Board of Examiners, right? Because that, what we call prior referral language, was removed, essentially meaning the section that said your referral was good for 1 year is struck out.
It took that out.
No longer there.
Took that out.
Does not exist.
Does not exist. Because of that, if a referring provider writes any finite amount of time, whether that be number of visits or duration,
like 2 weeks, like 3 times a week for 2 weeks.
Yeah, you get 6 visits.
That's what you get.
And then what happens?
Then that's it. You have to submit for reauthorization from, or you have to contact that referring provider to gain more visits.
And the patient would potentially have to go see that referring provider again before you could continue to do your job.
It's possible.
Possible.
So possible. That provider, you know, may take it upon themselves to write another referral without the patient coming to their office. But it's just as likely that the patient will have to show up in their office to get that new referral.
Well, what about evaluation and treatment with that?
Meaning, like, if a provider wrote, just evaluate and
treat?
Yeah.
They say, because that's what happens sometimes, right? Here's a prescription. This is, you need physical therapy. They write, physical therapist, evaluate and treat this. You have at it.
Because that's a medical diagnosis. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah, so that's one of the things we're waiting to find out. We don't know what that essentially is good for. The direct answer that I received when I asked about that was there is nothing in the new law that designates how long that referral is good for. So that's still open to interpretation. Could that mean that there is no limitation, or could that mean, no, you're still limited to what that, as you put it, prescription is? Which, by the way, that term prescription used to not apply to referrals. But now, given the fact that we're essentially moving into what they call episodic care, it becomes more like a prescription.
Or an order, if you will. My understanding in speaking with one of the licensing board members is that type of referral that doesn't have the specific restriction is usable for continuing care as long as you don't discharge the patient. Once you discharge the patient, that is the end of that episode of care. And if they come back to see you, that starts a new episode of care. The rules governing that new episode of care are what they're writing now.
So you could potentially just never discharge the patient.
Potentially.
Yeah.
But again, rules are being written now that might give a little bit more guidance about that specific thing.
And I'm not that worried because I don't discharge anybody. I don't. I've never got anybody.
Yeah, PRN.
I've never helped anybody.
PRN, come in as needed.
So what you're telling me was there used to be a huge barrier, a huge wall to getting to a physical therapist, right? You had to get this prescription, blah, blah, blah. And then you went through all that effort. Okay, I'm finally in, and I'm in now. This prescription is good for a year. They can help me with it as long, not, I don't want to say as long as they want, but as long as, you know, insurance, things work, mm-hmm. cash, things like that. But
as
now,
long as you confer with the referring provider.
Things, as long as we're checking in and everything's kosher. But now I do all those barriers, I do all those hoops. I don't know this. I don't, unbeknownst to me, is that how, right? They say you can come in for 2 weeks. I'm like, I got the shoulder pain. They say, you know what? You're going to go see them for 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're hustling. You got a busy treatment day.
Yeah.
Front desk just gave you the stack of papers. You're not looking through that.
So now there's the potential for someone to go to therapy and then have to go back to the referring provider every 2 weeks.
What if you miss that?
What if you miss it? That you're telling me that is what's coming, that is potentially coming in the future? It's this kind of back and forth, flip-flop, back and forth. Give me more prescription. Give me more visits. Back to the therapist. Give me more visits.
Yeah, it sounds quite a bit like that.
So
I don't know about every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? So 2 weeks is the number of business days for direct access, right? But as far as the referral situation, after those 2 or 3 weeks, if your residency or fellowship train goes, well, then they have to go get a referral to come see you. And that referral, if it is a constrained or a closed end referral twice a week for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever, at the end of that period, yeah, there's that potential where the patient has to go back and get something else.
Right, so now consider that coupled with the information that, you know, prior to us gaining this little bit of direct access, which will change the statistic somewhat, but in my mind, it's almost like a you know, Barry Bonds' home run record, right? It definitely deserves an asterisk, right? Texas is, sorry for any Barry Bonds fans out there, but Texas is ranked 47th out of 50 states.
Woo!
In number.
That's third place.
Hey, let's go. Let's go.
Let's go.
Third.
Not
third.
Oh,
we're third.
We're not third.
Well, where were we before this?
We were 47th out of 50 in number of primary care providers.
Oh, gotcha.
So when you think about
primary care providers, that's not PTs, right?
Well, it wasn't.
I mean, I thought I was a primary care provider.
Well, that depends on whether you're speaking.
That's what I was trained
by
to do.
Training or by, you know, by legal aspect.
Man.
So you consider the two things, right? These are the things that I think we need to consider the most, right? First and foremost, we serve patients, right? Did this help patients in terms of decreasing their costs and decreasing their wait times for getting the treatment that they need? You know, what are the wait times to go see, you know, a primary care provider in this state? You know, especially when after 2 weeks, that's what they're essentially going to have to do. Now, I don't have the data for that in terms of you know, private entities, but I will say that at the VA, the wait time is up to 21 days, up to 40 if you're in Dallas. So, I mean, that's a substantial amount of time to have to wait to, again, continue the care that you need. Now, the other part of that is, you consider the burden on quote-unquote primary care providers, right? If we're already 47th out of 50, and now essentially, you know, whereas we used to be able to get one referral and treat that patient for a year, now we get one referral and we're subject to whatever that amount of time is, right? That's another referral that the patient has to go back. That's going to essentially overload those primary care providers in terms of being able to see these patients and get them to the appropriate care that they need.
Well, I thought it was going to make it easier on them. Man.
I mean, you might as well go to the... What it sounds like to me is, correct me if I'm wrong, but you might as well have that initial visit to go get your PT script, and then just go ahead and schedule about three more, because if it's a 40-day wait period, you might as well just stay with it, right? Hey, I'm going to see you every day for the next 3 months.
And now, again,
not every day, but yeah, get your copay ready. See you three times this year.
So I try, again, I try to present things from both sides of the argument, right? One of the interesting things that I saw in one of these forums about direct access on Facebook was providers sharing information, or I'm sorry, physical therapists sharing information about certain providers through telehealth, right? That would allow them to essentially see a provider, we'll say a primary care physician or a physician of some sort.
Some recognized referral source,
right,
by the state of Texas.
Without losing a lot of time, right, because it's telehealth, it's pretty instant. You jump online, you get that, right? But that's still a $50
totally
copay. Yeah.
Oh, man.
On average, probably around a $50 copay. All right, so again, we look at, did we really affect the patient's experience with this? Did they save money on this? Well, maybe. Maybe in the short term for 10 visits, right? But what we know about generally most neuromusculoskeletal conditions is that they take longer than 10 days to get through simply just by tissue healing time, right? So is a patient better off after just 10 days, or will they potentially require more treatment?
So, I mean, if your residency or fellowship trained, 10 days should be enough, right?
No big deal.
Because you're a better practitioner,
so,
and you'll get them well.
Well, what's interesting about that...
Well, I mean, that's what Peyton will do.
That's what Peyton will do.
I need 15 days, though.
Well, this is where I'll be honest about my own camp, right? So I'm residency trained, and the research shows that the outcomes for residential trained is not any different than a general physical therapist. It's slightly better for a fellowship-trained physical therapist, right? But not better for a residential trained. So just to put that into perspective, right? I spent a year and a half going through my residency. I spent $1,700, right? That includes a membership to the TPTA to be able to sit for the board exam to gain my orthopedic certified specialist credentials, right? Now, again,
hey, we learned today that if you're an APTA member, you save 45% on the application and exam for that certification.
If by save you mean I didn't have to pay it at the same time as the examination fee, then yes, you are correct. Now again, $1,700 a year and a half's worth of commitment, right? And most people, I don't know, and I could be wrong on this, but most people can't go on to a fellowship without having that residential training. So you're talking about whatever else the expenses are for a fellowship, whatever else time, which in most cases I believe is around 3 years total, if you count residency and fellowship training, to be able to get 5 more days of treatment.
It's a good thing PT school is so affordable that we can afford all that stuff.
You got time for another podcast? Or?
So I kind of want to go back to the patient for a second, right? We got Phil Davis here, who you've owned and operated a clinic for how many years?
Here in Austin since 2011, so 8 years.
8 years.
And before that, I've managed multi-practice clinics here in town.
Right.
So I've been doing this for a little while.
Yeah, so thebomb.com, right? Peyton Sykes over here, Dr. Peyton Sykes, right, who's got the residential. I come in, I got shoulder pain. Golly, I don't know why my shoulder is killing me, but it is killing me. Can't sleep at night, can't lay on it. It's waking me up at night. Direct access. Here's two individuals. I really want, and everyone's a little bit different. Prognosis, how long can you guys take care of a shoulder problem?
Well, first and foremost, if you tell me that your pain is constant and never changes, then that to me raises the suspicion of what we call a red flag, right? If pain is not changed based on position, you can't find a position to make it feel better, you can't do anything, you can't throw a heat pack on it, like no matter what you do, it doesn't feel better.
Yeah.
That's first and foremost a red flag for cancer. So I'm not going to treat you, I'm going to send you back to the appropriate healthcare provider.
But what if it's not that red flag? It's like, no, I can do some things, I can make it feel better. It's just, you know, I'm reaching up, it feels kind of junky, and it's just not what I want it to be. I don't know where it came from. I can get through it. It's fine. But how long would you say that would take you?
Well, of course, everybody's a little bit individual, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we all
have... Do
you
think it'd take you 10 days?
In my experience, right, because the shoulder complex is so dynamic, right, it's the most dynamic joint we have in the body. You have you know, essentially 360 degrees, you know, of range of motion. I mean, there's a lot of different factors that play into that. Most of the time, to be able to reestablish range of motion, build strength, and then add coordination on top of that, no, you're talking more than 10 days.
And Phil, you the training room, right? I'm a pitcher. I'm a high school pitcher, or I'm, you know, and I've been throwing, and man, my shoulder's just been getting me lately. MRI says no tear. What do you think?
Sounds great.
This is where Phil outshines me, right?
One visit. I mean, one visit can take care of you. Boom. Direct access.
Boom.
Works.
Got it.
No.
Phil needs 2.5 days.
You didn't ask what clinic I was for.
I mean, it's complicated.
Yeah.
It depends on the details of what's going on with you. But
10 days?
More likely than not, no. Not 10 days, not 14 days. It's probably going to take a while, especially for a pitcher, where we're going to have to break down your movement, you know, from the ground up, figure out what's going on, and get you feeling better based on mechanical change. And it doesn't happen quickly like that.
No,
if only it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep in mind, too, this is going to somebody, a physical therapist, right, who is going to spend on average, you know, with you 45 minutes to an hour, at least in evaluation, right? And so you compare that to going to an overloaded primary care provider such as a physician, right? Again, I throw the stat out, 47 out of 50, right? We're not doing well in being able to reach the number of people in the state who need care. How much is that primary care provider going to be able to spend with you? So,
well, and how likely are they to come to the conclusion of what's actually going on with your shoulder? Are they going to be able to specifically diagnose that condition?
Well, I can't either.
I'm not allowed.
Yeah, you're not allowed.
Barred by law.
So what do you think they're going to do? They can't come to a conclusion. Maybe, hey, there's some pain medicate.
How about an MRI? How about an MRI?
Well, interestingly enough, if you go to see a physical therapist first, you are 29% less likely to get unnecessary imaging. Meaning, and what's interesting about that stat, I love that stat, because when you look at, and this just came out from the British Journal of Sports Medicine, who compared every clinical practice guideline in orthopedic care in terms of orthopedic pain, they came up with 11 consistent guidelines across all of those recommendations, and two of those recommendations were, one, advanced imaging was unnecessary in most cases, right?
How much does that cost?
Well, it's not cheap. When's the last time you got an MRI?
It's free.
Everything's
free.
And the second recommendation was that diagnosis of musculoskeletal pain should be in conjunction with a thorough physical examination. So again, going back to who spends a lot of time with their patients to do a thorough physical examination.
How well trained are primary care physicians in physical examination of, say, the shoulder? I don't know for sure, but my estimation is not very well.
And one of the things,
I'm not saying that they're not good at what they do.
Sure.
But what they do isn't provide musculoskeletal care. That's what we do.
This is one of the things that I ran into sort of in having conversations with people, and I respect this opinion 100%. You know, people, you know, wanted to make the point that, hey, you know, we shouldn't be against physicians. And I want to make it known, I'm not against physicians. As I said earlier, you know, I refer to physicians all the time, especially when there are conditions. I've referred out for suspicion of stroke, suspicion of vertebral artery dysfunction, suspicion of blood clots, suspicion of cervical myelopathy, all kinds of different red flag scenarios, right? As a physical therapist, I'm not even legally allowed to be against physicians, right? But I wouldn't be ethically either way, right? My job is to screen out for things that are outside my scope of practice and to refer those when necessary. And that is what every physical therapist is trained to do. Now, what's interesting to me is we talk about not being against physicians. And I want to say firmly, I'm not against any physician. But if a physician holds the power of whether or not a patient can see the appropriate healthcare provider, i.e. a physical therapist, then are they on our side as well? Is that professional relationship truly mutual? And I think that's the point that people need to realize, is that no, we're not against physicians. There are a lot of physicians who agree that physical therapists should have this ability to treat people autonomously, but when you have an entire association who says otherwise, that's a problem.
Yeah, and you'll have a really hard time getting the vast majority of those physicians who do agree to come forward against their own association. I know a number of physicians here in town that behind closed doors will say, yeah, you guys are the ones that these people need to see. But they're not going to come forward and say that. And that's why we and our patients' families and friends need to be the ones coming forward to say those things.
All right, call to action time. We got all this information. All the Texan listeners know what to do. Or all the Texan listeners, they've heard the information. How do we create change?
Well, so, you know, as as gloom and doom as this whole situation might have seemed based on, you know, and again, I try to present it as objectively. You guys have did a good job of leading me into certain opinions, right? There is one, in my opinion, very, very big, bright, shining spot about this whole thing, and that was the fact that prior to this legislative session, we have never had more than four legislators officially co-sponsor a bill. Now, when you look at, again, there's a lot of things that we're up against every year. I mean, year in and year out, every legislative session. So when you look at what was spent this legislative session, our association spent $38,000 on politicians' campaigns, right? The TMA alone, and this isn't even factoring in the TOA or the Texas Family Practitioners Association, right? Those, the TMA alone spent $200,000, right? So we... You consider the fact that the TMA has 50,000 members, and only about 45,000 of them are actually active practicing physicians, right? The other five are either retirees or people that are just associated, right? If we had 100% membership of every licensed PT and PTA, we would have about 20,000 people. You consider in those membership dues, right? That's going to make a significant impact. Right, and that's important, right? That, I'm not saying that money is not important, because having the money to be able to put into that political action committee and to help with the legislators who are on our side, that is a key part of it, but it's not the only way. And $38,000, as far as I know, is not more than what we spent in the past, right? And just to give you a little bit of perspective, we're only at 7,000 out of that 20,000 potential members for the TPTA. I mean, that's a problem, right? And this directly affects, member or not, this directly affects any PT or PTA that holds a license in the state of Texas, right? It affects you directly, as we just heard from Dr. Ryan Woolley over here. Now, the other part of that is, so you ask yourself, well, if those things didn't change, then why is it that this session, and again, I said we never had more than four, we had 38 co-sponsors going into the compromise.
And these are state legislators?
These are state legislators, meaning representatives or state senators, right? Now, after the compromise, we had 44, so an additional six joined on, right? That's a huge accomplishment. When you consider that, And the majority of those were state representatives, right? 36, I think, going into the compromise were state representatives out of 150. And the other two were out of the 31 state senators that we have. So 44 total out of 181, that's a pretty good percentage, right? It only takes 76? No, my math is way off. 92?
Yeah.
Am I right on that?
Sure.
Right. Yeah, 92. 92 out of 181, right? If you consider both the House and the Senate to have a 50% majority, I mean,
yeah,
that's not that far off, right? And so, yeah, I appreciate it. I got my mathematician over here. He's keeping me in check. The point of that is that we went from 4 to ultimately 44. That's a giant leap forward. And I think the biggest contribution, I mean, obviously there are a ton of people working behind the scenes on that, and I can't thank our association enough for the hard work that they do, right? But a large percentage of that is attributed to people you know, whether it was reached out through email or social media, making contact with their legislators and saying, you know, this is what we want to do, this is what we need, this is what's best for the patient and the healthcare consumers. So call to action is, one, first and foremost, to stay involved. Stay awake, right? Stay paying attention to what's going on. There's the Physical Therapy by Choice Open Group, which is on Facebook, that will continue, even though that legislative session is over, to provide form letters that you can send. If you're not comfortable writing a letter to your legislator, there are form letters that you can literally just copy and paste. There are information about how to contact them easily, so you don't have to go and search yourself. You're networking with other physical therapists, as well as that group being open to patients, to friends, to family, to hopefully other providers. We've got massage therapists, we've got PTAs, we've got a lot of different professionals in that group, and we hope to build it even further.
So you want clinicians to ask their patients to join the group?
Absolutely. And the hope is in the very, very short-term future that I'm developing a website that, again, does the same thing, right? You go onto that website, or if you as a clinician say, have an iPad or a computer in your clinic, you have that website loaded up, and then all that patient literally has to do is put their name and their address in, and that form letter goes directly to their legislator and says, hey, you know what, I've been here for 10 visits, I'm doing great, or 10 days I should say, doing great, but now my care is interrupted and I don't need to go see another provider.
It's about convenience, right? You have to make it almost unethical for them not to send a letter to their legislator, right?
That's the goal, you know, and that's what I tried to set out with, you know, with the group during the legislative session, was to make it so absolutely easy if you are a patient or a healthcare provider to literally just copy and paste and plug it into a form and say, this is what I believe in, you know, and I sit here like so enamored because I've gotten a ton of thank yous, right? And it's more than welcome, don't get me wrong. But the work is done by the people, both members and non-members of the association. Like I said, any licensed physical therapist or physical therapist assistant, this applies to you, right? And so it's you that did the work that contacted your legislator, right? It's you that sent those form letters, right? I just essentially made it easy for you to do that. And that was essentially my goal, was to, one, make you aware of what's going on, but two, make it so easy for you to contribute that it almost felt wrong not to.
And what's the Facebook group and the website called again?
It's called Physical Therapy by Choice. If you search it on Facebook, it's an open group. Anybody can join it. And I welcome anybody to be a part of that movement.
Are you on any other social media platforms?
I mean, I'm personally on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, but it's a personal account. It doesn't really directly relate to physical therapy or direct access.
You have a lot of good songs, though.
Hey,
you
I mean,
got
you
some
know.
Good lyrics in those there.
That was another life I still desperately
When's
cling
your next
on
show?
To. It'll be a while. I got some bigger priorities on my plate right there, now.
Man, any other closing remarks from y'all?
I my big thing is, I appreciate that you recognize that. You know, I am passionate about this, and it's ironic. Again, I said earlier, like, I never thought that I would fall into this, right? And it just happened by asking questions. And I think that there's a large responsibility by the people who lead in our profession to make these things known. And, you know, they are to some extent, but if I'm a practitioner in the state of Texas, and I don't know what this law is, you know, entails, that's a problem. And so just by asking questions, I fell into this. And my biggest concern is just making sure that people are aware of what is about to drastically change in the practice of physical therapy within the state. And I hope to keep you updated on that.
Get in the group. Get in the group. Be the change you want to see, right? Like one of the greatest philosophers of our time, said, you know, if I could change, you know, I saw all these people in the crowd, because I was getting beat up,
if
you got it,
you can change, and I can change, then we can all change.
All right. Physical therapy by choice.